forged from the fires that created a long-lost brotherhood of podcasts, comes the Blast Syndicate. We are made up of Focus on Metal, Inside Metal, Iron City Rocks, Mars Attacks, Metal Geeks, MSR Cast, Neckbreaker, Radioactive Metal, and Wiki Metal. We are the Blast Syndicate. Go to BlastSyndicate.com to find out more. Get blasted.
Hey, this is Lena Ford. You are listening to Focus on Metal.
Focus on!
Hey, Metalhead, Scott Thompson here, welcoming you to episode 260 of Focus on Metal. Things have changed quite a bit in the last week or so here on Focus on Metal. This is the third iteration of episode 260.
What?
That's right. I had one episode all set ready. I knew that was going to be episode 260, and then Richie popped in a really cool opportunity for us, and that suddenly became episode 260. And then just a day or so ago, I had yet another very cool opportunity, and that ultimately became episode 260 that you're listening to right now. However, don't worry, the other two things that were initially going to be episode 260 are still coming your way in the coming weeks as episode 261 and 262, unless, of course, something else pops in there in the meantime and things get shuffled again. But anyways, great show for you this week. Going to continue on with the authors. You know, last week we had author Greg Renoff with his great book, Van Halen Rising. If you haven't checked out that episode, definitely go back and check that one out. Had a great all VH talk with Greg about that book. And you can also learn all about that at VanHalenRising.com. However, this week we have one of our consistent guests that is direct from Canada, author Martin Popoff. We've had Martin on several times. Always like having Martin on the show. And he is gracing us with his presence once again this week. And why is that? Well, I'll tell you why. Because he just put out a great new book. It's called Swords and Tequila, Riot, the Classic First Decade. And as always, you can get your own copy of this and all of Martin's books at martinpopoff.com. And that is MartinPopoff.com. So if you're a Riot fan, I think you're really going to dig this book. Great stuff. And if not, you know, it might be a band that you want to go back and discover, especially if you're a newer listener and you're, you know, listening to this show and you hear us talk about older bands and you go back and go, wow, I didn't know about these guys. Riot is definitely one of those bands that, as a metalhead, you really need to go back and discover the magic and majesty that is and was Riot. And I would think that along with doing that, that Martin's book really provides a great roadmap to what's going on with that band, give you some insights, and give you a solid foundation to become a Riot fan. So a great Riot discussion in store for you this week. Hope you enjoy it. But before we dive into that, what do you say we do a track of the week? Sean Peck, Ross the Boss, Mike Davis, Stu Marshall, and Steve Bolognese. What does that all add up to? Of course, it adds up to the band Death Dealer, and we've had Sean on the show before talking about this great band, and they have put out their latest album. It is called Hallow Ground, and of course, that is available on Amazon, on iTunes. You can also go right to the Death Dealer site, that is deathdealer.co, and pick up your own copy of Hallowed Ground. We're hoping at some time in the near future, we may have Sean pop by the show and talk about what he's doing with Cage and with Death Dealer and everything else that Sean does. Sean is definitely another one of these guys that gets around in a lot of different bands. And, you know, why the heck not? The guy definitely has a killer voice. We did have the opportunity last month to potentially talk to another member of this band, but a few of our brothers on the Blast Syndicate, that is BlastSyndicate.com, sent some emails saying, you know, maybe you want to stay away from interviewing this guy. So we passed on it, just didn't suss out as a good opportunity for us. But we're hoping that potentially we'll have Sean come on and talk to us about what's going on with Death Dealer and, you know, everything else he's got going. Anyways, back to the business at hand. We're talking about Hallowed Ground, second release from Death Dealer. Of course, the first one, War Master, we had Sean on talking about that, and they had some great bundles they put together for War Master. When I heard this one was coming out and checking out the Death Dealer site, I thought maybe they would do a similar type of package for this one, but surprisingly, they didn't. I mean, they were so strong with what they did on the first one in regards to merch and really driving sales for physical product that I was a little bit let down that they didn't have something like that for this release. They do have the ability that you can get a CD and t-shirt combo, but not the killer packages that they had together for the initial War Master release. But, you know, reality, right? I mean, we buy these things not for the t-shirt and the posters and all that other stuff. We buy it for the metal that it contains. And obviously, Hallowed Ground continues on with what they did with War Master. Just a real strong album of classic metal. And realistically, what would you expect from guys like Ross the Boss and Stu the Hammer Marshall, right? Those guys are not going to go and give you an album full of oddball shit. You know it's going to be 100% classic metal. And that's what you're getting on Hallowed Ground. So this week, off of the brand new one from Death Dealer, again, it's called Hallowed Ground. This is Plan of Attack.
Stark, wait. We need a plan of attack.
I have a plan. Attack.
Hey, Martin, how are we doing?
Hey, doing all right.
Good.
Very cool chat with you again.
Yeah, you too, man.
Yeah.
Glad we finally get to be able to get together again. I know it's been a while, but definitely awesome book and a great reason to talk to you. In Swords and Tequila, Riot's classic first decade.
Yeah.
I've got to tell you, great book. Read it in 2 days. Essentially, couldn't put it down unless I absolutely had to do things like going out to rake leaves.
Yeah. I did a lot of that this year, too, believe me. Yeah.
But I like a lot of things about the book, but I'll start off with one thing that really struck me as really cool is that, you know, you always do really good forewords, but I felt like this one was your clearest statement of intent in the book that you've ever done. Like, You really laid it out, and if anyone could ever question why you did it, this one is just so clear. I was like, wow, after so many books, he's nailed down the perfect forward. So definitely very cool. And I also like the fact that you did it, you know, and really concentrated on that first decade. But then for those of us who are big Riot fans, you did that nice epilogue as well. But I like the fact that you really, for very good reasons, concentrated on that first classic bunch of albums. And I think that made it just, I don't know, for me, a much more enjoyable read.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I know. I definitely felt I had to rationalize why I did it that way. You know, there's a lot of bands that I think I would like to write books on, but have this long gaping maw of albums that I don't want to do my traditional song-by-song analysis of, like to give a whole chapter. And this was the perfect case for that. You know, those early ones albums were also magical for me. It was such a cool, magical metal time where, you know, there wasn't really much coming out of America. And this was just a really cool... I don't want to say meat and potatoes regular band, because there were certainly a lot more than that, and almost like you know, as I say in the book, sort of the honorary new wave of British heavy metal band at the beginning.
Well, yeah, and I definitely agree with that, and I think that's one of the reasons that I got attracted to them in the beginning, was that they really just the production on the albums, at least the first two especially, really had that classic new wave of British heavy metal sound to it.
Yeah, and you know, that's credit to Steve Loeb and Billy Arnell, the two producers, Sven Gally's managers, although it's a complicated story with other managers as well. And Steve, you know, he certainly, you know, there's a few unkind things said about him in there, but he can take it. He seems to be, you know, perfectly fine with the whole thing. He loves the book. But you know, you're right. I mean, the sound, I mean, I remember getting that first album from the Delete Bin, you know, 1977. I would have been 14 years old, and you're right, the production on that, a kind of a different production from Narita, and I guess Fire Down Under have a similar production, but they're both very high fidelity and bright, with lots of bottom end and lots of highs, and even lots of mids. I don't know how to call it. I mean, it's kind of like a hot, kind of like a white or red hot production. It's just very bright and dynamic, and yeah, there's just... That band basically did not screw up when it came to production.
I think it was interesting too, because, you know, even in your book you talk about how Billy and Steve were still pretty new to producing this type of sound. And, you know, Rock City has that, it's almost very echoey or ambient. And then I would think that Narita reminds me a lot of Def Leppard's first release, you know, the one that nobody bought. And then,
yeah,
and then after that, I think Fire Down Under has more of that, like that modern metal sound to it. Like they figured it out when they got to Fire.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people put Narita and Fire Down Under pretty close, but one sounds like the slightly you know, less self-actualized version of the other. And you're right. I mean, that's a really interesting comparison with On Through the Night, because both of them sound like the work of kind of bands that are part American, part British, really seem to know their metal well, but seem to be not crazy about it. They aren't wild and loose and fast, and there's almost like a cleanness to it. I really liked one of the quotes in there. Can't remember who said it, but basically the idea that they were almost like a smart, snappy dressing band, you know, here in squalid New York, and punk has taken off and they're out of step with that. And they just wanted to be kind of like a clean heavy metal band, and that's kind of the way they came off. They did dress that way. They obviously recorded that way. The songs are recorded without, you know, too much complication, but just enough complication. They're very straightforward. They all sound like they could have been singles, which of course is so much of the tragedy of that band. That's you know, I've learned from interviewing hundreds of people over the years that you know, they're, you know, Riot's a perfect example of a band where to make it in this business, you have to have a dozen ducks in a row, and Riot seemed to have a few things going for them, and then quite a few things not going for them, and you know, all of these things conspired to them just not breaking through.
Yeah, and it's amazing, you know, you take a lot of these songs and you play them for people that have never heard of them, and they're just like amazed that this band never made it. And you know, for anybody now, I can go, hey, you need to go read this book. And it really starts to explain it. And, you know, you talk about having Steve in here and I think that's really nice that he likes the book, because there are definitely parts in here where he doesn't come off well. But I think you put so much of his words in here as well that it's kind of hard to argue overall about the story that's being told.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a little bit of a lesson in here that people in bands don't realize how much it costs to run a band. I mean, there's one Steve quote where he says that. Now, you know, you almost expect any manager or anybody who's going to run off with the money or whatever to say that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, he explains it well, and I know that. I mean, I've also found that from many, many interviews, that they just don't realize how much all this stuff costs. You know, like, forget about just wrecking hotel rooms or rent-a-cars or rent-a Winnebagos or whatever. How many of those stories have you heard, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they just laugh about it, and then they don't realize that somebody's got to pay for it, and it's very likely going to be them. So, but that's not Riot's story. I mean, Riot's story is more, it does cost a lot to keep a band on a road and to promote a band and do all this this back scene stuff that goes on to make a band. You know, but having said that, you know, I suppose there's definitely you know, warranted frustration there that somehow they didn't break through. And you do see some revealing quotes there about how it seemed like possibly Steve and Billy both alienated people at the labels with their demands and whatnot. So it sounds like, you know, you definitely have to be a real people person if you're going to be that interface between the band and the powers that be. And it sounds like, you know, there's a very good chance that there was a bit of a weak link there too.
Yeah, I mean, you brought that out several times in the book of the people that were just saying, you know, those two crazy guys. We can't deal with those two crazy guys. And yeah, that is definitely unfortunate. I don't know. Overall, I thought it was amazing to go back and revisit the albums, but revisit the whole story behind it. And just the people you were able to pull in as well, almost having the entire cast of characters in the book quoting on it, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it obviously is a bit of a challenge, because obviously there's the tragedy that both lead singers are dead now, and the leader of the band, Mark, is sadly passed on as well. And, you know, Mark I interviewed quite a few times over the years, so I was fortunate to have that happen. But, yeah, it's a crazy story where, you know, there's the various record labels, there's the guys coming in and out of the band, there's a lot going on in that tight time frame. So, yeah, I suppose, I mean, the book basically covered, what is it, five albums plus live stuff and whatnot. And then, as you say, you know, I let the epilogue go as long as it needed to be, and basically touched down on all of those. It's got to be 10 or a dozen albums after that, and including right up to date with, you know, Riot 5, Army of One. And so, so it's, it's good that the band is going to continue. And, you know, Donnie has told me basically, or, you know, I guess we've talked on Facebook a little, but he, you know, they're keeping the band going, and he's, that they're busy making another album. So that, so they're going to go on, and they keep flying the flag. They've been to Japan. They're very good on the social media. So, you know, the band's going to live on.
That's great too. Cause that was a great album that they put out. And, you know, I was so disappointed after Mark passed, after Immortal Soul, and I was like, wow, this is great. And it was, I thought, you know, finally this guy is going to get really the full scale kudos that he deserves for carrying this flag for so long. And that, I think that made his passing just hurt that much more. But, you know, it was great to see those guys come back with, you know, with that, the new album under the new name, but still have all of that, the elements that were still there as well. They didn't just take the name or part of the name and go off with something different. It was carrying on where they left off.
Yeah. And you bring up Mark. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I get the feel from talking to him, and I hope it comes through in the book, that he, you know, he really was kind of a quiet guy that didn't want to make a lot of waves. And there were, you know, overbearing people or people that don't mind making waves, that are provocative, you know, people like Steve, and I suppose Billy as well. And the other sub layer of managers and all that, that were doing all the talking for them. And Mark's just seemed to be a guy that, you know, even, you know, I've been asked, you know, boy, it seemed a little cruel how Mark even dealt with some of the band members and stuff. And I just get the feeling that it's not really cruelty. It's more like he didn't want to be in arguments. He just wanted to make his music. All he wanted to do is play. And if there was a living to be had from it, that's fine. But he certainly didn't seem, you know, greedy about having to conquer the world. He just wanted to keep cranking out this stuff. And it started for him with, obviously, you know, all the old school metal greats that we love, you know, from the 70s, and that's the sound on those first few albums. And then he discovered more of a love for being more of a European power metal kind of guy. And that's where the direction took it, even starting with the CBS Associate years with Thundersteel and Privilege of Power. I mean, he started doing that then and even pioneering it to some extent. So it's funny, he evolved over that time, but he just always just, to me, just seemed to be a guy that it was all about the guitar and it was all about playing.
It's interesting, you know, you go back and you listen, even with Rock City, and you listen to the songs on there. And, I mean, you know, in 1977, 1978, most bands, when they would put out an album, it sounded very similar throughout the album. But you take that and you got a few songs and you got the guitar tone. Yeah, okay. And all of a sudden you get, Tokyo Rose, and you get something totally different. And that's very, very unusual for that time period. It almost sets the stage for how Mark continues to experiment all through his career with things like that.
Yeah, it's a good point. And then also, you know, the other interesting thing is that heavy metal is really not in vogue in America, and there's almost no bands doing this. And you get to 1978, 79, and everybody we love is kind of screwing up or going mellow. You think of Derringer and Stars and Angel and Kiss and Blue Oyster Cult and you know, Ted Nugent. I mean, I liked what Ted Nugent did in 79, 80 or and whatnot, but the sales are going down. Almost everybody is getting either poppier or breaking up or looking for something new to do, because it's punk, it's new wave, it's a depressed year for music. Yeah, what does Riot do? They get even heavier. Mm-hmm. And then come 1981, you know, there's basically still, you know, LA has not woken up from its complete lack of metal on a national scale. I mean, there were bar bands inventing hair metal, you know, in the background. But essentially, you know, I think back to that time, and when we talk to people, you know, what was heavy coming out of America in 1979, 80? And it comes down to Gamma and Sammy Hagar. I mean, there's just nothing. There's very little heavy metal. I mean, I suppose Ted Nugent is still rocking pretty hard. And Aerosmith is Night in the Ruts is a good album and whatnot. But, you know, so Riot was heavy when it was unfashionable in the late 70s. They were America's practically shining example of a new wave of British heavy metal band. But unfortunately, they didn't live in Britain. So there was them and perhaps Y&T at that time. April Wine from Canada was almost considered part of that thing. There's a bit of a thing going on here with a lot of people being on Capitol, which is, you know, a lot of that is discussed in the book as well. But, you know, you get up into the Rhett Forster years and all of a sudden, they're also too early for hair metal.
Right.
So they're like always ahead of the curve, doing something unfashionable, and then as soon as they're proven right, the band is in shambles, and you know it's a golden age of metal that starts in about 1983, 1984, and Riot, what do? They break up. They just basically go underground and just you know fight over scraps and try to figure out what they're going to do in that dormant period between about 84 all the way up to 1988. By the time 1988 rolls around, you know, what they're doing is a very strange, sophisticated, weird sound. It's part hair metal, it's part thrash, it's part European. It doesn't have a place. Metal's going great in 1988, but by the time they make their next album, 1990, they're still on a major label. Metal is declared an embarrassment, and they have to go underground yet again, just as, you know, they might have made some headway. So it's just a big, long story of bad timing.
One thing that I never realized was the whole San Antonio deal with them. I mean, that's just so bizarre.
Yeah, well, you know, that has a history going a long way back. I mean, somebody could, maybe there even is a book, a local regional book about this, but there's that one radio guy and radio station who loved classic rock down there. And up here in Canada, you talk to Rush, Triumph, Moxie, all these bands had a huge following in San Antonio. And before Saxon started coming here regularly, the only place they were known, it seemed, was in San Antonio. Budgie would make a specific trip to San Antonio and then fly home, no pun intended. So it was interesting. That seemed to be a real hotbed of old school hard rock. I don't know what the situation is there anymore. I really doubt it. All of us fans of this music are dying off rapidly. But at that time, it was, and they could do well there, and eventually they gravitated towards there. And you know, wrapped up in all that is Mark's being enamored with the whole Wild West idea. And that's why you have these songs like Outlaw, and Rhett Forster is in there with his bluesy Paul Rodgers sound and all this.
Back with 49er.
Yep. So eventually he moves there, and then there's, you know, there's a lot of back and forth with Mark. But it's almost like San Antonio's, you know, somewhat their base still.
It's I don't know. It's very unique. I mean, you talk about having the radio guy there, but I mean, there must be either he's, you know, like, legend or something, because I mean, even here in Boston, we had, you know, BCN was the local independent station, but they were, you know, they were the big gun here in Boston, and they would bring in, I remember them bringing in like Motorhead and Girls School and, you know, a lot of bands
right
into the clubs here in Boston, and yet it never became, you know, this amazing hotbed scene. And I get jealous. I look back at, you know, yeah. San Antonio and go, damn it, those guys had something special there.
He is a legend. I think his name is Redbeard. Does that strike a, I mean, he's not, I hope he's not a legend somewhere else, but I'm pretty sure the guy who is a legend in San Antonio radio, his name is Redbeard.
Okay. So sometimes you're in the middle of an interview and you don't remember all the facts quite correctly. And Martin is right. There is a legendary DJ from the Texas area called Redbeard. However, it is not the DJ that Martin is trying to remember. Ironically, that guy, Redbeard, at that time period we're talking about was actually based over here in New England in Connecticut. But the guy that Martin is trying to remember is Joe the Godfather Anthony. And apparently this dude is pretty legendary on San Antonio radio. And I guess a lot of people go back to his Friday night shows and all the great metal that he played, making San Antonio the heavy metal capital of the world. So again, that was Joe the Godfather Anthony. And a lot of good stuff written about this guy. Probably the best thing that I've seen written about him was by Metal Dave over at the website Too Fast to Die, and that is the number two in both of those. So if you go to toofasttodie.com, you can read a pretty cool article about Joe Anthony and all that he did for the metal scene in San Antonio, talking about him bringing in bands like Rush and all those guys into that market and introducing a ton of metalheads to great metal music. And coincidentally, in that whole article, there's even a Riot video that's posted on there. So very cool. And I will try to remember to actually put a link to that story about Joe Anthony up on focusonmetal.blogspot.com when I post the show notes for this puppy. So with that, and with all credit given properly to Joe Anthony, let's hop back to my talk with Martin.
Like I said, I get jealous when someone has a scene like that. I was doing the same thing you were doing. It's just, you know, you hunt down these gems in these record bins and you just go, oh my God, I can't believe I found this. This is so awesome. And
yeah,
you're the only one around who has any appreciation for what the heck it is you just found.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it must be said, you know, when it comes to finding someone like Riot in those bins, the first thing you see is that crazy seal. And that's explained in the book, of course, as well. You know, how, why and how that comes about and that thing becomes their mascot. But I remember getting that record for the first time and looking at that and thinking, this has got to be heavy metal from the cover. And incidentally, you know, and this is touched upon as well, but it precedes Derek Riggs and Eddie as a heavy metal mascot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yeah. And I don't know, I never minded the seal until it got to Restless Breed. And then I was like, all right, they lost me with this one.
Well, yeah, because basically they just didn't really get better at portraying the seal, essentially. It just became kind of stupid and slapdash. And Steve admits that, the Born in America cover, like, what is that? That's right. You just cut and paste the seal from the first cover, or Narita, actually, and stick it on there and then put some flags around it or whatever. It was dumb, right?
Yeah, it was. But, I mean, Rock City was a great cover. And I like how even, you know, having when you get to Thundersteel, it almost has that Rock City kind of feel to the artwork.
Right, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And you know, and you look at that and the title and the artwork, and they really are kind of pioneering power metal at that point. So here again, you know, they're doing something completely new and completely out of step that is ahead of its time. You know, if you want to get strict about power metal, you know, if you want to say they were pioneering it, I mean, a lot of bands kind of did. You know, you could put Dio and Accept in there and Halloween and Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, and you get a big bunch of bands pioneering power metal. But they were kind of a baby band doing power metal, and power metal really didn't take off until Hammerfall in the mid-90s. So there you go again. You know, this European metal thing just kind of goes over everybody's head.
Yeah, yeah, and especially here in the U.S. is, I mean, I know even some people that, you know, were big metal fans, and they, you know, oh, power metal, that's, and they don't even have the right idea of what the heck power metal is until they actually hear it and go, oh, wow, hey, I kind of like this. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame it never really, you know, caught on, you know, here in the States.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, if Riot's going to be remembered for anything, and they will, judging by, you know, the interest in the book and the people on Facebook talking to me about it, and you know, I stuck all those fan testimonials in the back as well, which was really cool.
Yeah.
You know, it just proves that even though this is a band that doesn't have, you know, even a gold record, basically Fire Down Under is their Montrose in a way, or their Badlands. You know, it's you know, you don't have to be a super deep, completely obscure metal fan to know that Fire Down Under is a metal classic. And it's going to live on forever. It's just amazing start to finish. Everything about it, as you said before, I mean, everything about it, when you play those songs for people, not only does it just sound like really cool metal, you know, well done or whatever, it sounds like stadium rock. It sounds perfectly like, you know, this should have been on a mat in hockey barns all over America as a headliner act.
Oh, absolutely. I do like the fact that in the book you also, you know, mention quite a bit the Montrose comparison as well, because that's, you know, that's another, you know, another one of these albums. I mean, it's just like Fire Down Under. You play that first Montrose album to people and they just go like, where the hell did this album come from? You know, yeah. And they rate it right up there with the first one from Boston or whatever. It's just front to back. It's got, it's rock solid. It's technically perfect. It's awesome. It sounds great. And it's like, yeah, it's just bad luck.
Yeah, and although the big difference is, the Montrose album is actually even more impressive because it's sounding like 6, 7, 8 years ahead of its time in 1973. Mm-hmm. What Riot's album is sounding like is the only band in America who's making this kind of music, and it's you know, if you just parachuted that album into the new wave of British heavy metal, you would have said it was one of the best new wave of British heavy metal albums there is, because it's just so well recorded and tight and well played. It would have to be up there with basically that Def Leppard album, as you say. But, you know, it's not doing anything new. Fire Down Under is just a really good, capable, great album by a band who is essentially still a baby band. But it's not like a groundbreaking, it's basically just high quality heavy metal from a baby band at a time and a place where you weren't getting any of that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I never thought so much about it until after I read your book, but how much that they are so much like a New Album band. I'm thinking, oh my God, I could make a New Album playlist and slip a song in from Narita or Rock City, and someone who didn't know would think they were just another British band. It has so much of that sound element. It's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the main thing that gives it that is the speed. And you know, the year it's in, that the fact that it is a pretty good high singing guy, but you know, I've been living, eating and drinking New Album for a while because I've got 2 long New Album books coming out in the next couple of weeks,
which I cannot wait for.
Too. Thanks. Yeah. And, you know, I do mention that, you know, as you go through the timeline and quotes process of these books, I touch down upon, you know, a good dozen bands that I consider the honorary new album bands, and Riot is certainly one of them, and they are the most deserving when it comes to anybody from America or Canada, for that matter. But of course, there's Accept from Germany, and Warning and Sortilege from France. You know, there's really not much from too many other countries. You might throw Heavy Load in there from Sweden. But the ones that came from America and Canada are almost quite melodic and poppy, because Kerrang had that love of the American melodic sound. They used to call it Wimpem. And all of those bands got covered in Kerrang all the time. But Riot was by far the heaviest, because you got to remember also at this juncture, Y&T is having their troubles. They're getting dropped with London, or breaking with London. Their last album was 1977. They go all the way to 1981 with Earthshaker, which is on a new label for them, A&M. So they kind of sat out that period when Riot is you know, being very exciting with Narita, and then they come back with Earthshaker at about the right time. At the same time, Riot does Fire Down Under. But the interesting thing is, and I never really thought about this before, Fire Down Under is the type of album that makes Y&T, even on their third album, look old. Mm. Riot sounds young and spry and energetic compared to Y&T by the time they're even doing Earthshaker, which is a blisteringly heavy album. But even the next two from Y&T sound positively almost like retrograde or old school compared to Riot on Fire Down Under. But once Riot makes their style change on Restless Breed and Born in America, and if you compare those against Mean Streak and Black Tiger, they're kind of on par again.
And then you kind of wonder what would have happened, and I'm glad they didn't, but, you know, what would have happened if they decided, okay, we are going to make that album of commercial songs and do what the label wants, and, you know, would those have ended up sounding more like the later Y&T albums that a lot of hardcore Y&T fans go, I can't listen to Down for the Counter. You know, would they have ended up in that kind of a bucket?
Very good point. They probably would have, but they seem kind of defiant as well. They really seem defiant and didn't want to be commercial. There's some funny stuff in there about their feud with Quiet Riot and getting compared with Quiet Riot. So, you know, they did their commercial thing, but it was, again, pre-hair metal, and their version of commercial was doing a couple of novelty covers and being a little bluesy and a little bit mellower. But they didn't, you're right, they didn't bring in the braying synthesizers and the big wet snare drum sound and all that. They fortunately or unfortunately were gone before all those abuses came in.
I think too, they must have had at least a somewhat of a difficult time to maintain that. If you kind of wonder, you know, at what side Billy and Steve fell on that, because at that point, right, they're still producing them in their studios, and, you know, they had to have been looking at the label and the potential to get more money and getting payback for what they're pushing in the band, and you wonder what that dynamic was at that time point of Mark and the guys deciding, you know, screw it, no, we're staying with what we know and not go commercial, even though, you know, you guys might have the big payoff. It must have been interesting.
Yeah, I get the feeling morale was so low. I mean, basically everybody was just looking around left and right, you know, figuring out how are we going to quit this thing. I think they were all fed up with the whole situation. And don't forget, you know, the last album of those three was on a small Canadian dance label called Quality. I mean, here in Canada, it never felt like they fell off and were on a minor label because, you know, frankly, it was odd. I mean, with them getting their Attic record deal early, Attic Records was a fairly thriving Canadian record label. You know, I was living in a small town in Western Canada for a lot of that, and then Vancouver, Victoria, Toronto later and stuff. But basically, every Riot album seemed perfectly well distributed all across Canada. They never felt like that small a band up here.
Yeah. Well, at least you had the advantage of that because it was definitely sporadic around here. And, you know, you'd have to go, like, you know, into Boston and into, like, around, you know, Cambridge to Harvard Coop, something like that. You might find it down there.
Yeah.
Maybe the original Newbury Comics on Newbury Street would have it in the import bins, but you were never going to find it in some of the other popular bigger record shops that were chains or whatever. It was non-existent.
Yeah. I'd be interested. I mean, what did you think of the Rhett Foerster years, those two records?
I was always for whatever reason, just more attracted to the tonality of Guy's voice. And whenever I would, you know, listen to, you know, Restless Breed, which I did kind of like the overall feel of it, but I was always like, I wonder what it would have sounded like with Guy doing it all. And of course, at that point, I was too young to be thinking about, well, Guy would never write about this type of situation and this story and all that. I was just more into the song and the coolness and the heaviness and trying to figure it out on bass and all that. But I didn't like it as much as I like the Guy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I might have put possibly Born in America on par with Narita, but nothing beats Fire Down Under, that's for sure. And, you know, Born in America was when they kind of turned that corner back to being a heavy metal band. And it's interesting, at that point, the type of metal that they were somewhat pursuing, that gritty street crime kind of heavy metal, was, you know, they might have been picking up a little bit of that vibe of, you know, what you could, they're starting to see and be aware that there is a heavy metal culture at that time. And perhaps we were people who were part of the origins of this. So we own this, so we can do any kind of metal. So they're almost looking around and saying, we're seeing a little bit of a pride in heavy metal and a heavy metalness and street metal, and the new wave British heavy metal by that point is already well behind them. And, you know, frankly, by that point, you're almost looking at the rise of places like Shrapnel Records and Metal Blade Records and that kind of metal, which is the early version of that term power metal. I mean, I remember when power metal first was semi-defined, it was really, well, we used to joke about and call it poverty metal. It was that loose, clanky, almost like machine shop. It ain't hair metal and it ain't thrash. It's just somewhere in between. And it kind of got defined by a lot of those bands on Metal Blade. You think of your Lizzie Borden's, and boy, now I'm forgetting most of them. Savage and bands like that. And at the esteemed end, at the better end of it, it would be bands like Metal Church. But I think of Laz Rocket and Vicious Rumors and those kinds of bands. That was the original version of power metal. And so you almost hear the original definition of power metal on Born in America, and then you hear the more gleaming and European and what I used to call a frilly sleeves metal or ballerina metal version starting to rear its head on the two CBS Associate albums.
Right. I mean, one of the standouts, I guess, on Born in America, and I mean, you talk about putting it out there, is the song Heavy Metal Machine. I mean, it sounds, you get to that one, and you're like, whoa, what's this track? It stands out.
Yeah, and I really think a lot of the material on there is pretty good. But that is the first one that has production that's a little more scrappy as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all the first four have slightly different productions, but they're all, you know, you would call them 90% correct. They're high fidelity enough. They're going to sound good on any stereo. You know, my version of high fidelity is literally, I don't need the treble turned all the way up and I don't need the bass turned all the way up. So as long as they put enough of that on a record, it's essentially correct. And anything past that is personal taste. But that one has a definite kind of scrappy, loose drumming, loose mid-rangey kind of distorted sound to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And it's interesting that they throw that the cover of Devil Woman on there, too. I mean, that was one thing that always threw me off. You get up there, you get through the first three songs that are pretty cool. Vigilante Killer is pretty cool. Heavy Metal Machine, I just think, is great. And then all of a sudden, you get their own take on Devil Woman. It kind of throws me off a little bit.
Yeah, and I hate that song. I've always hated that song. The original, the cover, doesn't matter. And I totally hate When I Was Young as well. Just I just found both of those to be way too old school to put on there. And, you know, which brings up a point. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, the idea that the new wave of British heavy metal bands were the first ones to be metal aware enough that when we're going to cover something, they're going to think like we are as young fans. And that was perfectly personified by all of those B-sides that Iron Maiden used to play.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, they used to bring out just the coolest, most obscure stuff that that might have been heavy in its original, but they knew how to even make it heavier. And here was Riot kind of succumbing to label and management wishes and maybe the bluesiness of Rat and putting on these two very traditional, almost like, you know, old school marm frock rock on there that just didn't sound gleaming and modern enough.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. And you're right about the Maiden stuff. I mean, who would have thought that Cross-Eyed Mary would ever sound as cool as it does when they do it?
Yeah, and Women in Uniform, you know, covering Skyhooks and stuff like that. And they covered Montrose. They were smart enough to cover Montrose. And they knew that you know, there was one song on the second Montrose album that was better than every song on the first Montrose album. Just one, and they found it, of course, because they're smart enough, right? So they did I Got the Fire.
They definitely did amazing stuff. And you're right, Women in Uniform was great. I love the fact that when they recently released all the 7-inches, the first one I bought was the one with Woman in Uniform. I'm like, oh, I'm finally going to have this on 7-inch vinyl. Great stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it was a fun project. I mean, I did never think I would do a whole book on Riot, but it just kind of all fell together. And then, like I say, I mean, the only way it really becomes a whole book and doesn't take months and months and months is I don't treat all of those latest albums as the whole thing. So it's a quick read. It's not one of my super long books. It's not, you know, tons and tons of words, and which is also one of the reasons I put the price down a little bit. But people are loving it. I think people, nobody's ever come to me and said, boy, it's a little shorter than your usual books. You know, it's still whatever it is. What is it? 200 pages, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, it's and I can see a few other bands in my crosshairs that I could see doing the same sort of thing on. You know, I have half a mind to do a Queensryche book a little bit this way.
That might be good. I mean, it's the same kind of a situation, I think.
Yeah, and I would be able to easily have enough to do you know, a book that doesn't get too out of control, that would end with probably Promise or Here Now Here in the Now Frontier. The one after Empire or Promised Land, and then I would stop it there, and then after that it would be a long epilogue where we go through, you know, all the rest of the albums, but basically cover off the classic era in just like the same sort of, you know, labor of love detail that I did all these five Riot albums, and then you know, the rest is a little more compressed.
Yeah, I think that's an absolute perfect band to do that for. Absolutely. Because I do like the way you did the epilogue with, you know, like an album like Inishmore. It's like that was the perfect amount of space you gave that album.
Yeah.
Like, awesome. Good. Move on. You know, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Too many of those. And, you know, they're so in the wilderness at that time. Half those things are coming out just in Japan, and then they're on Metal Blade. And then, you know, they got a German deal and an American deal, but they're basically a, you know, a pretty small, obscure band by that point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really like this one. And I'm literally coming off of the BOC book from you. And I had like a weekend gap between that one and this one. But this one just, like I said, this one just really lit it up for me. And just great stuff to to go back and, you know, read about the albums again and find out some of the story that I never knew about a lot of the shuffling and all of that. And then, you know, a lot of times when you get in the situation of a band like this, where there is all this finger pointing back to the managers, I mean, you'd never have some of those managers from Sabbath's past come up and speak in a book for you as much as Steve did in your book. So yeah. It's really great to get the story from people on the outside and also, you know, right from the manager. So it's I thought it was really nice and balanced. You walked away going, all right, I really think this is one where I know the story.
Yeah, very cool. No, glad to hear it. I mean, Lou Kuveris got his copy. He hasn't read much of it yet, but I was surprised that, you know, Sandy Slavin, who basically, he seemed a little hostile that a book was coming out on Riot, but as soon as he got it, he read it and thought it was perfectly fair. I was quite pleased with that. So he's come around, and you know, Donnie's got his, and Steve liked it. So yeah, everybody's digging it, getting a lot of good fan response as well.
That's good. I mean, I don't think anyone said anything bad about Sandy either. It was all like what a fantastic upgrade he was when he came in the band and what he brought and you know, the kind of the different stylistic stuff she had. And so I think he was portrayed really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm amazed at how many books you continue to produce. And I had this weird moment tonight as I'm getting ready to call you. And and I said, you know what? I got to ask Martin this. Does it ever amaze you, or would your 1977 self feel really bizarre looking at your phone contact list today going, holy crap, I can't believe I've got this guy's number or that guy's number? Or do you ever have those moments?
Absolutely, because, you know, I grew up in a small town in BC, 10,000 people, you know, even the big towns I went to, they're in Canada. Toronto's, you know, a move and shake in town, but when you're in Vancouver or Ottawa or whatever, or Hamilton, you know, you're still not in any kind of rock and roll mainstream. So, you know, it's funny. It's like I never thought I'd end up doing this. And I also, you know, I was a super crazy fan, but I didn't think there was ever, you know, an idea that you would actually write about this for a living. As a kid, you don't even know that job exists. These great circus magazines that arrive in your post office, you don't even think they're, you know, people ask me, oh, who was your favorite writer in circus? I didn't even look at who wrote any of the articles. I just thought this stuff just appeared out of nowhere, right? So, you know, I am amazed at it. And, you know, I also, it's a funny thing. I never had that feeling, oh my God, I can't, you know, one day I got to meet these guys. Oh, it's going to happen. How do I make it happen? Because you really never, ever, ever thought in a million years you would ever run into a rock star in your entire life, you know, to death, right? And, you know, I remember the very first ones I ran into, Blue Oyster Cult and Pat Travers in the elevator. They were staying at the same hotel we were staying at in Spokane, Washington, seeing Blue Oyster Cult at the Fire Unknown Origin tour. And I got one to sign an American dollar bill that I had on me. And, you know, and I was reminiscing today about how we went on a family vacation across Canada, and you know, we're gonna see Kiss in 1977 in Montreal, big bad, you know, city across the country. And for whatever reason, we're driving by the arena, and there's Cheap Trick getting into a limo, and it's like, I remember looking at that and going, oh, well, isn't that something? Yeah, no major emotion one way or another. Didn't freak out, you know, because again, I just thought, well, I'm never going to meet any of these guys. I mean, there's oh, look at that. It's almost like just seeing a statue or something, right? So, it is funny where you end up. But, you know, I suppose I was somewhat destined to end up here just by being such a crazy super fan, right? I mean, most people that are crazy, crazy super fans of something, you know, I think way more admirable is when you're a crazy fan and you actually become an artist. I didn't become an artist. I just write about other people's art. You know, I want to do art and I want to paint, and that's what I'm going to do next. I definitely have to do more art in my life. I have done some, but, you know, a fanatic at something often ends up in that great profession, or they end up a rock star because they loved doing that. Well, some of us ended up doing this because we were super, super fans. Other people go the route where they go through retail record stores. I did that same thing too. I know a lot of record executive people who, you know, they got their start because they just loved record stores and they started running the record department. I did that in three stores. But I've talked to a few people lately, like, you know, you just, you just fall into this stuff because you love it so much, and the path just takes you somewhere, and you go, "Wow, well, crazy how we all ended up here." And you're in the same position. I'm sure you didn't think you'd be talking to all these rock stars all the time, right?
No, I mean it's weird. Probably the weirdest one is, I mean, I look at all the people in my address book, and every time I see it, I go, "Holy crap, it's weird. I've got Andy Bolton's number." Like, that's just like,
yeah,
me away. It's just, you know. Yeah. Of course, I know a lot of people are going, "Who the hell's Andy Bolton?" But to me, I'm like, "Holy crap, I got Andy Bolton's number." And it's,
I love
just bizarre.
This book, you know, the address book is funny because the address book is in pen, right? And, you know, mine, I'm old school, right? And I flip through it and I've got all these 01144 numbers for all UK rock stars, right? You know, and many who have passed on since then. And it's like literally, you know, one day it'll just be cool to like take pictures of those pages, you know, when those numbers are no longer valid anymore.
Yeah.
It really is impressive. I mean, it's pretty amazing because half the time, you know, now people realize I've never abused these phone numbers in any way. So, you know, nowadays people just give me the number and say, "Yeah, just call them at home," you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing too, is people say, "Oh, you know, do you keep it on your phone?" I'm like, "No, this is a privilege. Julian Turner gives me a cell phone number. I don't put it on my cell phone in the address book because I would never want to expose that guy's number anywhere." It's like, no, it's at home.
Yeah. You know? Exactly. Funny. Well, I love what you guys do. It's pretty amazing. You know, you guys have such a long history of so many episodes, right?
Yeah. It's going on. It's over 5 years at this point, just cranking away.
Pretty cool.
Definitely, you know, guys like you writing the books and just keeping the fires burning and, you know, also, I mean, it gives us a lot of ideas for like, wow, you know, people might be interested in this story or that story, and allowing us to have a seed to flesh out on as well. It really helps.
Well, hopefully we do this again not too long from now, because like I say, the first new wave of British heavy metal book is out. Basically, they're going to ship it December 1st, so I'll get it about the 3rd or 4th, and I'll send you one right away. I owe you one, in fact. And then the second one, the second part, is literally about 10 days after that.
Nice.
So I'm going to have basically 250-page small print, massive, massive new wave of British heavy metal history books before the year's out.
That is awesome. Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed Smoking Valves. I'm one of the nutballs who basically read page after page, one by one, every one of them. And a lot of them was just huge memory flashbacks. And I mean, you're one of the few people that's covering a lot of this stuff, especially New Album. So I love every time you put the stuff out. It's great.
Cool. Yeah. And what I did with these two is I designed the covers and the fonts and everything to look exactly like Smoking Valves. So when you put the three together, it's going to make a cool little trilogy.
Oh, nice. Great. I love how the purple books match up and stuff. So that's great. So, of course, why don't you give out all your social media and your website addresses for everybody so they can hear it right from you?
Yeah, so basically I have www.martinpopoff.com, and every single one of my books is for sale there with the buy now buttons for America, International, and Canada. So I, you know, everybody pays by PayPal now, but there's a separate page, full description, pictures of the cover, sometimes inside pages of every single book I have for sale, which is probably about 35 of the 50 titles. So that's all there. I'm readily available on Facebook. Got a lot of friends. I'm very active on Facebook. I don't use my Twitter very much, but you can find me on Facebook. But, you know, I sign all the books. Mail order of these books is actually my main source of income now. So essentially, I'm a mail order place of my own stuff. So I sign them all. I'll sign them for Christmas. I get this time of year, I get a lot of women coming to me and saying, "Sign it for my husband or for my boyfriend." You know, happy to give deals on multiple orders because I'm just making one package up and sending it to one place. So, yeah, martinpopoff.com. It's all there.
Awesome. And I'll say, too, I always love when I get the books in because I never know how they're going to be wrapped up. Although a lot of times I seem to get Asian stripper ads, which I find highly humorous. And
there's
and
reason for that. Yeah.
My kids go, what do we not know, Dad? But I'm one of them a few ones back. I got a page out of a 1974 edition of Sounds, which blew my freaking mind.
I know. It's funny. So basically, there's a Entertainment Weekly in Toronto every week, and I usually just grab four or five of them and take the staples out, and that's my outside wrapping. And then to make sure that not too much, you know, there's no ink or whatever coming off the newsprint stuff, I usually wrap it in something else, and that's where, I mean, my current one is I've got pages and pages of Japanese burn that are the inside page.
Yeah, because So It's a Tequila came wrapped in a Max Cavalera Japanese interview.
Cool, yeah.
Awesome. I'll tell you, I love having you on every time, Martin, and I can't wait to talk to you about the new album stuff. I'm sure that everybody listening can't wait to hear about it. But again, guys, go hit up the website and order yourselves up some books, order your loved ones up some books as well. Always good stuff. I think everybody out there that gets a Martin Popoff book will appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Scott. I mean, this has been amazing. I mean, you obviously always know your stuff, and it's just a great two-way sharing of all this old arcane knowledge we have stuffed in our head.
Yeah, I know. It has to be good for something, right? It's cool. And of course, Richie couldn't make it down tonight. He was like, oh my God, you're doing the Martin thing. I can't make it. I'm saying hi for Richie.
Okay, very cool. Hi, Richie.
All right. Well, thanks again, Martin, and have a great rest of the night. I'll talk to you again real, real soon.
Thank you.
All right, man.
See you later. Bye. Hang it up. Okay. See ya.
Can't do a Riot episode without playing Swords and Tequila, right? I mean, that's like an essential requirement. So there you go. A little Swords and Tequila off of Fire Down Under by Riot. So that's a great Riot discussion tonight with Martin Popoff. And again, you can head over to martinpopoff.com and pick up great book, Swords and Tequila, Riot, the classic first decade. And as Martin said, there's another 30 some odd books that he has up there for sale. Lots of great stuff. Got, you know, series on Deep Purple. He's got his Ye Olde Metal series. He's got some great hardcover books on Rush and Iron Maiden and album art and the backstage passes. Lots of good stuff by Martin. So again, head up to martinpopoff.com. I mean, we are into December now, and I'm sure that a lot of you, like me, are looking at your holiday list and seeing some gaps there that need to get filled for your for metalheads around you. And a book from Martin Popoff is definitely a great holiday gift. And of course, you know, hey, metalhead, open up that book and see it signed by the author as well. Usually with some kind of little heavy metal witticism thrown in there as well from Martin. And again, like he mentioned, and he just did it really briefly, but if you are buying the book from somebody else, just let Martin know at checkout. You know, if you're paying by PayPal, you can do the comment to the seller. Let him know you want it signed to somebody else, and he'll do that. And shortly thereafter, you'll get a little package in the mail, all wrapped up in interesting newspaper articles. And I'm sure that you or whoever you give a book to for Martin will be very happy with what they've got. And once again, thanks to Martin for taking his time out to talk to us again. And I am really looking forward to, one, getting a hold of both of those volumes of Nuwabum stuff from Martin, as well as talking to him all about that. So as we get ready to roll out of here tonight, just want to mention that I think that the next two episodes coming up, the stuff that got pushed off in order to get this one out, and really I did that because I wanted people to know about the new book from Martin as soon as I possibly could, and also to let everybody know that, hey, he's got two more books in the pipeline in the first couple weeks of December. And I just felt like I needed to get that out on a timely basis. So that was kind of the impetus for the swapping. But also on tap is a great interview that Richie and I did with vocalist Robin McCauley. And, of course, Richie was all fired up to talk to a fellow Irishman. So that was going to be one of the episode 260 projects. And also in the works is, of course, all of our Little Mountain Sound episodes. There's no way I'm getting them all out before the end of the year, but I did have one that was almost partially completed that was going to be the original episode 260, and that is Little Mountain Sound episode 6 with James Kotak. So both of those should be coming to your little metal ear holes in the next couple weeks. So what else do I got to talk about here at the end? Oh yeah, that's right. We got a compilation album. I'm sure if you follow us on Twitter, you've heard announcements about it, but we have a brand new compilation album, 40 great metal tracks from some artists that have been here on Focus on Metal already, as well as some artists that'll be on Focus on Metal shortly, but it's put together by Online Metal Promotions along with Merrick Media and, of course, your friends here at Focus on Metal. Best thing about it? It's free, my metal brothers. Absolutely free. So you could go to focusonmetal.blogspot.com, and on the right-hand pane, you will see a cover for the compilation. You can just click that. It'll bring it right over to the download link. You can get yourself your own copy. And by the way, that cover was designed by frequent Focus on Metal guest Maxwell Carlisle. And also, you can go further on down the page of focusonmetal.blogspot.com, and you'll see a blurb that'll show you all the bands that are involved in the compilation as well. And you can also pick that up at focusonmetal.net. If you're on the main homepage, if you scroll down past the current episodes, you will see a big old banner ad there for a very kick-ass metal compilation. So that is a wrap for this week. As mentioned, you can head up to focusonmetal.net. You can keep up with us at focusonmetal.blogspot.com. You can touch base with Richie at Facebook, and you can also follow us on Twitter. And we do have a YouTube channel there as well. Every so often, we pop things in there, mostly just videos and stuff we think are very cool. But you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. That has been in operation for the past 5 years now. So there you go, all the usual social media places that you can hook up with us. So that is a wrap for this week. Hope you enjoyed our mega riot discussion with Martin Popoff. And again, go to martinpopoff.com, get yourself some books, and also support our track of the week artist, Death Dealer. That is deathdealer.co. Grab yourself a copy of Hallowed Ground. So stick a fork in it. This one is done. So for Richie and myself and everybody else here at Focus on Metal, have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again next week, remember,
Focus on Metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.